Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
The first audience that ever answered me. Why am I lecturing this year on plays? To be frank, after 40 years, I have had too much pure philosophy. I finally understand why Ayn Rand needed to express her ideas in the form of art, to make them concrete and applicable to life. And I'm in effect reversing Ayn Rand's lifetime progression. She started with fiction and ended by writing pure philosophy. I started for decades trying to get her philosophy clear, and now I feel a very strong need to turn to art. Not necessarily to create it, which is another story you can ask me about in the question period, but to immerse myself in it. And my favorite art form, and of course there's a tremendous option here, is drama, theater, plays. So I am being selfish in this course. Besides that, I may say that literature is the easiest art to talk about since it involves concepts, and plays are usually shorter than novels and epic poems. So it has a practical simplicity also. I love the theater. A play is at once to me the most abstract and the most vivid form of literature. It's abstract because the author gives you only dialogue. All the interior life of the characters, their introspection, most of the narrative and visual detail you supply from your imagination, or at least the actors do. The author gives you only the bare essence of drama, just some key conversations, that's all. And you have to imagine and provide the rest. And to me, this makes it an extremely vivid art form, more so than a novel or even a movie, precisely because it is so bare and essentialized. It's stark and stylized. Now, I warn you in advance, or remind you, that plays are written to be acted. So we're doing the equivalent of reading a musical score in this course, which is not the intention of the composer. You have to read it imagining that it was perfectly realized on stage, brilliantly cast, set, costumed, staged, lighted, acted, directed. But that is not going to be our concern here. I wish to heavens we had a company that could stage these plays right after the discussion of them. It would be beyond a religious experience if we had. Our course is great plays as literature, in other words, with focus on plot, character, and as philosophy. Now a word about philosophy. I don't want my opening remarks to be construed as that I'm now indifferent to philosophy. I still need and want, as every human being needs, philosophy. In other words, abstract meaning view of life. And I have chosen plays that I call great, G-R-E-A-T, by a twofold definition of the term. Great as art in terms of aesthetic execution, brilliant plots, heroic characters, etc., and great because they include, not necessarily explicitly, but at least implicitly, a total philosophy. They are not plays narrowly devoted to one theme. There are many excellent, magnificent plays which are one theme or narrower play, such as The Miracle Worker, for instance, or many of the plays of Terence Rattigan. But I have not included those in this course because I'm requiring for inclusion a whole view of life be implicit in the play, including metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. Now, this combination of a total philosophy and an aesthetic execution of genius is so rare that only a handful of such plays, to my knowledge, are extant in the entire Western canon. The only one that I know of that I am omitting that is great on all accounts that should qualify for this course is Cyrano de Bergerac. That certainly belongs in this course, but it's simply too well known, I think, to an objectivist audience. And that's the only reason I had for omitting. You will see that there are no pure comedies in this course. I don't know of any comedies that fulfill these criteria. But they're not all heavy tragedies, although they incline that way. Now, this kind of play, the kind we're going to focus on, adds, in my opinion, to the very quality of your life. Quality in the sense of scale of vision, as against the trivial or even boring routines and repetitions of daily life. And quality in the sense of uplift or exhilaration, which is possible even in the case of such an awful tragedy as Othello. In this case, the uplift comes not from the sense of life, not all of these authors are consistent in that regard, but from the sense of admiration you experience at the brilliance of the author's aesthetic means and at the scope of his vision. Scope does not necessarily mean truth. It means the grand scale survey of the total universe. I draw in my mind a very firm line between amusement, casual amusement, and great plays. The former can be fun, it kills time, it relaxes you. It can be like having a Long Island iced tea. But the latter is a metaphysical experience, deeply moving and profound. And my test here, just subjectively and emotionally, is my life better for having experienced this play? Now, I would certainly not say yes to about the vast majority of the movies I read, for example, even those I like. Nor would I say yes about most of the plays. But I would definitely say yes about the great plays, about all the plays in this course, even the ones I violently disagree with. I would not want to have lived and died and not had the experience of confronting and reading these plays. Now, all these plays, as I've said, have a philosophical meaning, in effect, a whole system of philosophy implicit in them. But they are not only philosophy. And I want to ask you not to read them as ideological policemen. Read them first as plays, as art. Respond emotionally to the characters, the dialogue, the drama, the music of the words, the events, the universe. Do not read these plays first for their message. Let me repeat. Do not read these plays first for their message because they are not nonfiction tracts. The crucial thing they offer is the concretization of reality. You know the objectivist definition of art, the recreation of reality according to an artist's metaphysical value judgments. The creation of a world. And to get what a play has to offer, you have to enter and live in that world. And you do it at first without being able consciously to identify what kind of world it is. First, you have to see it, and only then can you define it. So you have to just let yourself go in your first reading. Let the story take you over. Submit to it as to a lover that you are going to judge later. But right now, you want to experience the quality of the foreplay or the climax. Let yourself be led by it or raped by it if necessary. Do not let yourself say, aha, this character just uttered the primacy of consciousness. That one is a total altruist, etc. These are not a set of ideological cues, and you are not engaged in a mindless stimulus response reaction here. After you have experienced and know the essence of the story and the characters, you'll see how easy it is to come back and identify the theme and evaluate the overall philosophy, which will not necessarily be in the obvious lines that struck you in the first reading. So have I made it, said enough, wasted enough precious time to say that the first thing you must get is the events and the characters, not the message or the meaning. The meaning is the last, not the first thing, because it emerges from the rest. So in sum, we have three purposes in this course. Number one and above all, pleasure. The sheer pleasure of exciting art, both in its means and its scale. And then philosophic detection, finding the philosophy in the art. And then at the very end, and not until then, objective judgment, an exercise in objective evaluation of art. Can you or can you not prove your analyses of these plays? And I'm going to give a handout next class, which will be the subject matter of Lecture 8, which is no longer a free-for-all question period, but a two-hour-plus discussion of your answers and mine to the handout that I'm going to give you next time. I was afraid if I gave it to you this time, I would scare you off. Now, I am trying to make real and accessible to you what your schooling has probably killed forever. My mission is to rescue the inspiring and magnificent classics of the past, which are now languishing, generally unread and unintelligible. And I must tell you at this point that translation is everything, since only Shaw is in an easily understandable English original. Bad translation, which is 98% of all translation, destroys the greatest works. What would you think of a novel of which the opening line was, "What personage is signified or otherwise denoted by the appellation Johannes Galtium?" That's who is John Galt. Now, every play has 15 versions written like that. Now, I've chosen translations carefully to try to minimize these problems, but I don't have perfect translations. So as a general warning, I tell you, never start a play until you sum through it and see that the language is easily accessible to you. I would like the language to be great, to be beautiful, to be exalted, but at the same time, I want it above all to be colloquial and easily understood. And if you find that there's too many thee and canst and wouldst and hadst, etc., throw it out and come back to one that's more written on the comics to get the meaning clearly. All the rest of the artistic and philosophic considerations just disappear. You should be able to read it as easily as you watch TV or a movie. If you can't, even with the best translation, then read it through slowly once and figure out what it means and put your own writing in the margin. Oh, this means no, or whatever. And then read it through proper. But until you get that problem out of the way, you can't turn to the play. Now, we're going to discuss each of our seven plays under six headings. The same six headings in the same order for each play. The brochure indicated that I would make analytic remarks about the style of each playwright. If I had had the time to do that, we would have seven headings. But I'm basically unable to go into style given the amount of other material and the widespread desire which has already been expressed to me that there be some chance for questions. So, basically, I'm stopping without a detailed discussion of style. And in our 6 points, they'll emerge this morning as we go through Antigone. Let's plunge right into number one, which is just simply introduction. And this will consist of a brief orientation to the playwright, the period, the background. Just enough so we can then dive straight into the play. So now we're going to come to the introduction to Antigone. And I want to tell you here how theater got started in human history. It started, as did so much else that was great, in Greece. It started as religious rites honoring the god Dionysus. And at first it was music, singing and dancing, performed by a chorus. Now, the first big innovation, you see, in the early years, everyone participated. It was just group song. But the first big innovation was that they developed what's called the separation of the spectator. Or another way of putting it is aesthetic distance. That is, someone contemplating the spectacle rather than participating. Someone getting a special and unique kind of pleasure, not from doing, but from observing and immersing his mind and senses in what was happening without himself doing it. That was the birth of performance art before spectators. And that was not yet theater, that was a concert, basically. It occurred to someone to introduce one other element into this situation. That is narrative, story, plot line, taken usually from Homer or Hesiod, Greek mythology, almost always already well known to the audience, but now they had the idea of enacting these stories to the music in front of the spectators. And that was a definite development at a definite time period. And so for the first time we had a fusion of music and narrative being contemplated by a body of spectators. Or we had singing and story as a spectacle contemplated for its own sake. Or poetry and plot enacted on a stage. And that is the birth of drama. Something utterly new and wonderful in the world. Now, since this is the background and it evolved from the worship of the god Dionysus, the religious features of Greek plays should not puzzle or bother you. Every once in a while there are various hymns to the gods, and that's simply a survival of the earlier origin. The chorus itself is a survival of the period when it was primarily a singing art. And in the actual ancient Greek plays, the actors spoke, but the chorus sung. And at first there was only one or two actors, and then they added more and more actors, and gradually the chorus began to shrink. But I don't think you should be put off by the chorus. The chorus has functions which all modern artworks have, only it's not given to so obvious a device as a group of people commenting from the sidelines. The chorus is valuable as a device of exposition. It tells you things that happened before the play or off stage. It's great as a vehicle of community reaction. If you remember the cocktail party in the Fountainhead movie, we want to know what people think of the Enright Building, and they zip from one couple to another at the cocktail party. Well, the chorus basically fulfills that function as a taste of what the community thinks about the latest development. And in Antigone, the chorus is a particularly undistinguished group of fence-sitting pragmatists who are afraid of Creon. The chorus can function as the single actor in the story. It might, but it doesn't have to be the expression of the author's view. It can be a tool of special emphasis. As a rule, I would say take the chorus as a single person, as a character. Forget that it's a chorus and don't let it throw you. Now, a few words about Sophocles himself. You know there's, of course, the big three, not counting Aristophanes, who wrote comedies. There's the big three serious dramatists of Greece, Aeschylus, or Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. Now, I made my choice from Greece on this basis. Aeschylus is too religious for me. Euripides is too journalistic, too socio-political. Sophocles is just right. He is profound and also worldly enough to be here and on this earth. According to Aristotle, who strongly admired Sophocles, Sophocles' greatest play was Oedipus. And there's no doubt that if you're going by plot alone, this is the greatest play ever, Oedipus, because Just think of the plot situation of a man searching for a murderer, discovering that it is himself that committed the crime. But despite that fabulous plot, the best plot in Greece, the play Oedipus is just too fatalistic for me. It's so thoroughly governed by divine curses and men as puppets pulled by the strings of God that I felt you would have difficulty relating to it, and I have difficulty relating to it. Antigone, on the other hand, is a heroine who truly has free will, who has free choice. She is the one unequivocal case in all Greek drama of a thorough free will character with no gods pulling the strings. There's a little hint here and there, but vestigial, really nothing. And that's why I picked Sophocles' Antigone for this period. Just for some dates, Sophocles is 497 BC to 406 BC. So he's a 5th century BC. He's contemporary of Socrates and the Sophists. Plato was only about 21 when Sophocles died. So that tells you how early we are, and Aristotle, of course, wasn't even conceived. Sophocles wrote 125 plays. Now, after the combination of the early Christians and the barbarism of the Dark Ages, of the 125 that he wrote, 7 have survived. And Antigone is one of these 7. In my opinion, the most pro-man play in all Sophocles. It was produced in 442 BC, when Sophocles was about 55. So he was that intense an idealist, you know, when he's getting on in life. Number 2, that's our introduction. Now we're going to plunge into an analysis of the Antigone. And the first crucial thing in every play is to identify what? The message? The theme? No. The main characters? No. How would you know which characters are main? It's not by length of dialogue. The first thing that you must grasp is the plot theme. Not the plot, but the plot theme. So that's going to be number 2, right after the general introduction to each play. This is a term of Ayn Rand's that she used in literary analysis. And I'll give you a definition of it. The plot theme is the essence of the action situation stated in a sentence. You must be able to send it in an inexpensive telegram. The essence of the action situation stated in a sentence. Now, the word essence is in there, and the word action is in there, and those are both essential. Now, for instance, I'll give you a rough statement of the plot theme of Atlas Shrugged, which I could refine, but just for example. The producers of the world go on strike against their exploiters. Now, this is to be contrasted with 2 other things, neither of which is the plot theme. In one extreme would be the abstract theme. In the other extreme would be a synopsis of the story. Neither of those are the plot theme. For instance, in Atlas Shrugged, I could go and say the abstract theme is reason is man's means of survival and altruism is its destroyer. That does not tell you the plot. It does not tell you the essence of the action situation. It is not a statement of a situation with characters, events, so on. It doesn't say somebody does something, which is required for a plot theme. Nor would it be a plot theme to say, in Atlas Shrugged, the producers discover that the most important issue in life is reason versus mysticism. That is purely cognitive. That is philosophy, not a story. A story cannot be simply somebody learned something important. Now, if one mistake in identifying the plot theme is to equate it with philosophy, the other mistake is to equate it with a synopsis of the events. For instance, what is Atlas Shrugged about? And then you'll get, well, Dagny comes into the railroad office one day and she sees that her brother James is wrecking the Mexican line. So she goes to Reardon to get some metal, but he's having trouble with Lillian, who's etc. Now, I could go on like that for 100 pages. Utterly useless 100 pages. That is what you call a synopsis, a blow-by-blow, scene-by-scene summary. And it's of value only to someone who hasn't read the play. It's like a substitute for reading the play. Otherwise, it's a waste of time and you learn nothing from it. We want a formulation for each play, the essential action situation, not the theory, the philosophy, and not the blow-by-blow. We want a one-sentence key to unlock the whole thing, which will give us implicitly the major event, the ruling conflict, the main characters, the entree into the total work. And then on this basis, after we know this, we will easy enough be able to grasp the abstract theme and the philosophic meaning. And this is a matter of logic. The only way to prove what the theme, the philosophic or abstract theme is to show that it is inherent in the characters and the action. But the only way to know what is inherent in the characters and the action is to know the essence of the action. That is what determines the details of the plot, the nature of the characters, and thus the message and meaning of the play. And therefore, that is what must come first. To understand any play, to grasp why it develops as it does, why it has the characters it does, what it means, you have to always start with the plot theme, the condensed essence of the action. So what is the plot theme of Antigone? In other words, the central action situation in one and hopefully short sentence. Now, in some of these plays, the sentences have many clauses. But the goal is the shorter the better. Now, my method of defining the plot theme, or of reaching the plot theme, is just to plunge in with a crude statement about the action, blurt out something, and then refine it gradually until you end up with the essence. And in all of these lectures, I'm going to just give you my own mental process as I actually went through, because you can't look up the plot theme. All you get is either from the commentators is the philosophic theme or a synopsis. Because the plot theme requires thought and therefore is unavailable. Now, in Antigone, I don't say you have to start with the way I blurted out, but this is just a recreation of my, you should end up at the same place. I started off with one person defies another. Now, obviously, that's a little bit vague. Generalize. I don't know what kind of people, what the context, no idea who's, what kind of defiance. So I don't have an actual story or situation yet. I have just a pretty empty relationship. One person says no to another. But for instance, is it Rourke defying Francon? Is it Keating defying Rourke? Is it my daughter defying me as to her bedtime? The plot theme has to be concrete enough to depict specific characters in a specific situation. Well, of course, once you see that your theme is too vague, you want to push toward concretization. And you might then go to the other extreme and fall into a synopsis. And for instance, I had a series of preliminary seminars in preparation for this course, all brilliant PhD candidates, but they were learning the technique of play analysis, and one of these students gave this as the plot theme. A woman honors her dead brother in a burial ceremony against the edict of a king who sentences her to death. Out. Much too detailed. That is closer to a summary or a synopsis of the play. And if we're going to throw all that in as the essential, we may as well go all the way there. A woman honors her brother who was killed in battle because he tried to attack the city in a burial ceremony against the edict of a mean king who thought that the brother was a traitor, even though her sister Ismene objects and her lover Hymen fights his father. I mean, you can go on and on like that, and that is not any longer any good. So we've got to find the essence, which is not just one person defines another, but it's not a blow-by-blow either. Now I'll go right to my answer and then defend it. You can take this down. If you take anything down on any play, the most important thing is the plot theme, because every word I have chosen deliberately, every word needs defense, and I have to be able to defend why each word is in it and why only those words, why I left out what I left out. So these are highly calculated. This is my definition of the plot theme of Antigone. A young princess defies a powerful king over a moral issue. A young princess defies a powerful king over a moral issue. Now, this gives us a specific and real situation, and yet it's not a concrete-bound synopsis. It gives the action of the essence, and let me defend it in steps. Young princess. Well, I have to give some identity to the defier. Princess conveys sex, which is an essential of a real person, and also stature. It's somebody high-born, and that suggests potentially strong-willed, independent, proud, as opposed to a young scullery maid, you know, who you would expect to be a little more withdrawn. Now, young, however, suggests her age, her inexperience, potentially her vulnerability, perhaps her youthful idealism. So young princess gives you something to work with. It suggests a real character, a real type of situation. Now, what about, why not just defies it? Why do I put defies a king? Well, obviously, it would be a different play entirely if she defied her grocer. And why do I put powerful king in? For the name of, the sake of literal accuracy, because she defied Queen Elizabeth II, no play. This had to be a king that can do something if he's defied. And now, the third crucial thing that has to be put in, defies over what? That is the most crucial. Is it over a whim? Over her boyfriends and her dating? How long she can play Nintendo, which is a continuous moral issue in my house. No, it's over a serious question of right and wrong. A serious moral issue. I didn't put the word serious in because it's implied. If she's willing to stake so much, it's a serious issue. Now, notice that the specific moral issue is not included in the plot theme. That is a detail. The burial of her brother in another variant of the same play could have been birth control, euthanasia, turning her parents over to the secret police. There's 100 different moral issues that would make the same essential plot theme in the same essential play, the same conflict, the same meaning. What counts is that it's a moral issue, not a financial one. She's not in need of money. Not a romantic one. The thing does not revolve around, will she and Hymen get together? And not just, she feels like, to hell with it, she's going to assert herself. She feels a solemn moral issue that she is bound by, and that defines the level of engagement and the type of conflict. And so I come up with, now it's easy in Sophocles because plot themes did not get to be very complex at this stage. They had just barely been thrown into the mix. So we get a young princess defies a powerful king over a moral issue. Now, as soon as we know the plot theme, we must right away, as still part of that same number, state the defining conflict of the play. The defining conflict. Every great play depicts conflict. Every great play depicts conflict. One character pursues a value, another opposes it or pursues the opposite, and they clash head on. That is the heart of a play. That is why we call it drama. And then, of course, comes the resolution. One wins, or maybe both lose. But if there's no conflict, that means there's no story, no values, no play. To grasp the nature of a play, therefore, right after you've done the first thing, which is identify the plot theme, you state the essential conflict. And remember, we're not stating it in philosophic terms here yet. We're not on the level of abstractions. We state it in terms of action. And here the essential conflict is between which two characters? You can read it off of the plot theme. The young princess and the powerful king, Antigone and Creon. And what is the conflict in action terms? We don't know yet from deeper meaning. She wants to take a certain course of action. She wants to bury her brother. And he intends to stop or punish it. He forbids it. That's it. That is the central conflict of the play. The action conflict. Now, there are many other conflicts, especially in a great play. But in a really great play, all of the other conflicts revolve around or are derivative from the basic one. For instance, Hymen versus Creon is fighting. He's fighting his father because he's on Antigone's side in the main conflict. Antigone versus Ismene. She loves her sister and doesn't want her to get involved in this struggle to the death. Eurydice versus Creon. She's enraged because of what happened to her son as a result of Creon standing up to Antigone. Tiresias versus Creon. He tells him what the gods think of him. So the play, as any great play, is jam-packed with conflicts. That is an essential of a great play. But they are not just a series of I hate you, you hate him, she hates her. They all flow from and are integrated to a central conflict. And to understand them, you must know that at the outset, and if you've stated your plot theme correctly, the central conflict should leap right out of you. In fact, in a sense, the plot theme is nothing but a statement of the central conflict. In action terms. All right, number three. Every plot theme is developed. So we call this plot development. In other words, the author, having conceived the plot theme, has to concretize it, dramatize it, figure out a certain order of events, and then tell it as a step-by-step story. So once we have the general plot theme, the next step is, how does this translate into a story with what Aristotle called a beginning, a middle, and an end, which are the three crucial parts of any play, if it's worth talking about or reading? Now, before I give you the plot development, or we can also call it the plot structure, which is the concretized implementation in terms of a series of events of the plot theme, I want to give you some observations, assuming that Sophocles began with the plot theme. of what he would have had to do to get from this plot theme to the actual story. Now, I don't have any historical records of this. I'm just recreating what I think would have to be the type of prophet. Well, of course, he had to choose the particular moral issue he was going to dramatize. And he picked a very common Greek principle, the importance of respect for the dead and of giving proper burial to the corpse. Now, this principle was clear to his audience. It was accepted by all as an obvious moral necessity. Now, I want you to understand that this idea, the need of respect for the dead and proper burial for the corpse, is just as valid and relevant an idea today as it was then. If any of you have the misbegotten, wrong-headed, and utterly false idea, well, I'm a modern man, there is no afterlife, I don't care what happens to a corpse, so this play leaves me cold, you are dead wrong. And there's no option about that. Because if you have any values at all, you do care what happens to a corpse, certain corpses. Now you imagine, for example, that your wife died. You could change the sexes for me if you're a woman. I'm not going to keep saying he or she. And President Clinton makes a public declaration that Hillary never liked your wife. And therefore, he proposes to have your beloved's corpse thrown into the gutter to let the rats eat it. Now, what would your reaction be? You would be outraged, and undoubtedly, if you have any moral fiber at all, you would just disobey him flat out. And that would be exactly like Antigone. And the deeper philosophic principle here is that man is an integrated union of mind and body. The body by itself, therefore, is not meaningless, even to an atheist, let alone a believer. The body is the last vestige of the great value that once was, and as such demands respect. And you can see our attitude today, our valid attitude, even in regard to transplanting organs from dead bodies. The legitimate agony and conflict that families go through in regard to mutilating the corpse of the beloved. I have had in a form of this problem, I had to write a living will. And it was a ghoulish thing in which, at a certain point, they itemize all your main organs. And then you have to match up which donor. Do you want your liver to go to this organization, your kidneys to this, and so on. And at a certain point, I said, absolutely, I'm not giving my kidney to that place, you know. So it made a difference to me. Now you'd say, well, you're going to die, so what do you care? But I cared in the sense that that was me, and so far as I can dispose of it, I want to treat it properly. It comes back to the question why there are burial ceremonies still to this day. Because the body remains a symbolic value even after death. Antigone's burial of her brother is a concretization of her reverence for values, her reverence for her brother's person. You remember her speech about how irreplaceable her brother was to her. And as such, we moderns should absolutely be able to sympathize and care about her plight with none of that feeling of, well, we're above corpses. So suppose he picks that moral issue. Now he must devise what we call the backstory, one word. In other words, the preceding events which form the context of the present. Characters don't act in a vacuum. They need a situation that has already taken place as the framework. And every play has that kind of framework. It's called the backstory. What happened before the story started? And here Sophocles takes the backstory straight from Greek mythology, and he doesn't bother telling you in the play because
He assumes his audience knows this stuff inside out. In later centuries, it becomes a feat of skill to sneak this backstory in without boring the audience, so that you find out all the things that you need to know without feeling the author is saying, hey, before we get started, I want to let you know so and so and so and so. And it becomes a genius of exposition, it's now called, but Sophocles is taken for granted. In any event, here is the backstory that he took from Greek mythology. Two brothers fall out over who is to be the heir to the throne when their father dies. The father was Oedipus. And their uncle Creon was put temporarily in charge. They fight each other, the two brothers, and they both get killed. One was defending Creon, the other attacking him. So Creon naturally regards the attacker as an enemy, as a traitor. Now, we're given very little information about these two brothers and what they stood for. All we're given is generalized sympathy for Antigone, and thus for her brother Polynices that she wants to bury. We're not told about either brother's politics. We have no idea which of them, if either, is for freedom, which of them is either is for tyranny. There is no way to judge from the information presented in the play whether Polynices was really a virtuous man or not. We're merely given a clash, which we must take at face value. A rebel killed in battle, the king he fought is outraged, the sister who loves him is adamant. Now I think you can, on that level, sympathize to an extent with both, without having to know the political credentials of the various characters. All right, say now, we're still working out the plot development. We have a concrete issue and a backstory context. We need to milk it. There is no good drama that doesn't squeeze you and then squeeze you worse and then squeeze you worse and hit you in the face with the conflict. And this is where the real genius of the dramatist comes in. He has to make the basic conflict ever more exciting, ever more fraught with implications and suspense. And I call that milking it. Now remember, it all has to go back to the plot theme, the core situation. This is not Hollywood we're talking about. He can't take off in a spaceship war or suddenly have dinosaurs running across the screen. It has to be logically implicit in the plot theme, not in special effects. And this is where the real genius comes. Well, to recreate Sophocles' thinking in some terms, maybe he did it subconsciously, but just thinking aloud, first thing he must have thought would be, well, there has to be a penalty for Antigone. This is a useless play if she defies Creon and he says no, and she says, I'm going to anyway, and he says, okay. Something must hang on this conflict. And of course, in real drama, it's almost always the supreme penalty, which it is here. Now, that's not enough, though. Let's make it worse. Suppose she has a lover. And suppose the lover is Creon's son. So that the son's fate hangs in the balance, and Creon really loves the son. So he's terribly torn. And at the same time, Antigone has a further reason to want to give in, but she can't give in. So it's worse for everybody. And what about if we throw in a sister of Antigone, say? Somebody who's a nice girl, but she's not as decisive as Antigone. She tries to stop Antigone, but she's torn. Maybe Antigone is right, but she loves her, so she wants to take her side. So Antigone will have to deal with that too. And then what about if we throw in a mother of the lover? You see how you can go on. And you created a whole nest of characters at each other's throats, all stemming from and expressing this one fundamental conflict. Now, in a really great dramatist, this goes down to every detail. Every detail milks the conflict. So, for instance, You do not see what you see on TV. You don't have the messenger come in here at the beginning and say, "Hey, King, they tried to bury him." No, that would be awful. We need a buildup. We need, even for that little piece of information, Creon is raging. The messenger is terrified. He has to speak, but he's afraid to speak. Even he is in conflict, so the note is struck before the action even begins, to do it or not to do it, to defy him or not. And he finally speaks and summons his courage. Now you see, that's just a detail, but it's all a way of milking the core situation. And when you finally finished, if you're a genius, you get a story structure or plot development with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Now that is the three parts of all good plays. It was, in our time, was called the well-made play, but it's proper to any, it applies to all of our seven plays. Believe me, I would never pick as a great play a non-well-made play. So here are the three parts for the Antigone. This still comes under plot structure. And I give each three parts the same title for all three plays. A, the basic setup, that's the beginning. That's the early part of the play, enough so you know what the situation is. The basic conflict has to come into existence. So for our play, that includes the chorus gives you the backstory. Antigone comes on and we see what type she is and that she intends to bury her brother. Creon comes on and we see what type he is and he issues the death penalty. That's it. At that point, we know the basic story. Now that, in a way, is the hardest to write, because you've got to hook your reader and get him interested in characters that he doesn't know and a story that he's not involved in. But if he does that well, you're gripped, and then you go on from there. Now then, the juiciest and most enjoyable is the middle. That is the build-up to a climax. You take that basic story and you intensify the conflict. You make it stronger and worse and more ramified. So, in our story, that would be, she actually buries the brother. And then Creon says, "Find the villain." And Antigone confesses proudly and he says, "It's death for you." Now, is the play over? No. Because after all, he may still relent when the chips are down, and she may. So we still haven't reached the top of the rise here. We have to find out what's going to happen when each of them is pushed to the limit. So first we see Creon. Hymen and Creon fight it out. Creon is adamant. He will not relent under tremendous barrage of logical argument from Hymen. That is wonderful argumentation, brilliant poetry. It's the kind of thing I would give anything just to read aloud, one line topping the next, if we had unlimited time. In any event, Creon is adamant, and he's prepared to let everybody drop dead. He won't give in. Well, then the only chance of averting the head-on collision is if Antigone gives in. So we reach the scene where she's shown in a moment of softness, which is very true to character. She bewails her unmarried state. She regrets that she's going to lose her life before she's able to have a husband, child, etc. You seem to have a moment of hesitation on her part where our hearts are in our mouths. What's she going to do? We still don't know, you see. So there's still rising climax, rising action. And then she makes her decision, which was never really in doubt, but now for the first time we see that she's going to go all the way. And that is her last speech to Creon and to the city of all around her. She says, "You see me now, the last unhappy daughter of a line of kings, your kings, led away to death. You will remember what things I suffer, and at what men's hands, in other words, at what kind of swine, because I would not transgress the laws of heaven. And she turns to the guards and says, come, let us wait no longer. So they're not dragging her to her fate. She's not, she stands on her code and says, okay, let's get it over with. Now that is the climax of this story. The definition of a climax, which every good play has. It's the point in a story where you grasp what is ultimately going to happen. Which side in the conflict will finally triumph? Or conceivably, both would win or both would try, both would lose, but typically one wins and the other loses. A climax is the point in the story where you grasp what is going to happen ultimately. Which side in the conflict will win, which will lose. And that is the end of the second of the rise to the climax. At this point, you know that Antigone is going to be crushed. It's irrevocable because she's inflexible and a powerful king is committed. And that leaves us only the resolution, the third. Now, in a great play, this resolution should be fraught with suspense. Because even though the climax has told us what to expect, we don't know how it's going to happen. How will she die? Who will go with her? What will happen to Creon, etc.? So the resolution should be also a tumult of suspense, even though in a well-constructed play, you know what's going to happen, but if it's a really great play, you hope against hope that the inevitable is not going to happen. Here, the resolution starts with this plague striking the city and predictions of doom. Tiresias, you know, the blind seer. Now, seers are always blind because they're not distracted by this world. They're in touch with another one. And, of course, he's an entirely sympathetic character as drawn by Sophocles. He confronts Creon and terrifies him with the information that the gods are angry because they had said corpses should be buried properly and Creon had arrogated to himself the right to cancel their decree. Creon gets scared fast. He rushes to atone to bury Polynices and save Antigone, but just at the expense of taking 1 minute, but for what I think is an exquisite scene. we saw her lying. This is 234, if you have the translation that I mentioned. She had made a noose of her fine linen veil and hanged herself. Hymen lay beside her, his arms about her waist, lamenting her, his love lost underground, they're down deep, you see, crying out that his father had stolen her away from him. When Creon saw him, the tears rushed to his eyes, and he called to him, what have you done, child? Speak to me. What are you thinking that makes your eyes so strange? Oh, my son, I come to you on my knees. But Hymen spat in his face. He said not a word, staring, and suddenly drew his sword and lunged. Creon shrank back, the blade missed, and the boy, now this translation says, desperate against himself. A better translation says, torn between grief, rage, and penitence, drove it half its length into his own side and fell. And as he died, he gathered Antigone close to his arms again, choking, his blood bright red on her white cheek. And now he lies dead with the dead, and she is his at last, the bride in the house of the dead. I can't even read that without tears coming to my eyes. That is what you call a Greek tragedy. That always gets me, that passage. And I put it to you that if you have that similar effect, something that powerful, that in the context of anything, you're lecturing early in the morning to hundreds of people, it makes you cry. That is a great play. Just one scene like that is all you need for a great play. Now let's just, Diana's telling me that our 6-minute break is coming up, but just so that I can feel it, because we did start 5 minutes late. We made a start on number 4, characterization. And that means we have to identify the main characters, not all the little ones. It's like plot theme. Plot theme gives us the main event. Characterization now gives us the main characters, including their motivation. And we should be able to read it off from the plot theme, because we need the characters required to enact the plot. Characterization is really a further concretizing on the author's part. It tells you more about the universe or the reality being created. And of course, the first question is, who are the indispensable characters? In some plays, it's tricky. But in this play, self-evident, there's only 2. Antigone and Creon. All the others are variants, go-betweens, foils, messengers, etc. Now we have to look at the motivation of each and the essential attributes of each. We're going to start with Antigone, the title character. She is what is called the protagonist. Protagonist means the character whose decisions move the story. The decisive moving force. The source of the momentum of the play. The title usually reveals the protagonist. And in this play, she chooses to defy Creon, and he simply then reacts to her defiance. So she becomes the emotional focus of the story. Let us take a 6-minute break here. So I would like to suggest that if you're going to use the facilities, you make a mad dash, and if you're not, just get up and stretch, because I'm really going to start at 11:29:06. The central characters, if the play is to be a success, must have strong and opposite motivations. And that must be convincing to you. That way we have a battle of values throughout the play. The more that the life and the future of a character hinges on the depth of his passion for something, the more our excitement and involvement. So the characters have to be passionate, but of course they have to also be convincing. Not just empty floating abstractions, but real, possible, alive. Now, Greek drama has the wonderful blessing that the protagonists are always alive with passion for something. And Antigone is a wonderful example. The depth of character that Sophocles could bring off in just a few scenes with a handful of lines of dialogue is amazing. And that in itself as a feat of characterization entitles him to the reverence of the ages as an artistic genius. Now, of course, we know in action Antigone loves her brother, and she's dedicated to the burial rites that he deserves, even at the risk of her life. But more broadly, she is an idealist. To her, values, the morally right, comes above everything else, even she will risk her life for them. She's clear-sighted. She has no inner doubts about what is the good or what is the right. She's not a modern going around saying, who can know? She has what is a very rare thing for a person or a character, moral passion. Not just personal passion for the man that she loves, but passion for the good and the right, the passion of a moralist. And she determines the good independently, at least independently of her society, independent of the government's decree. She's willing to stand alone against the world. So she has, as one person put it, the strength of a man. She's even stronger than a man, as the Greeks imagined these things, combined with the nature and desires of a woman who can lament that she has to die before she has known bridal bed or the nurturing of children. Here is her final, unrepentant, unyielding statement. I have done no wrong. I have not sinned before God. Or if I have, I shall know the truth in death. That is obviously a technicality that she's putting in just to cover the record. She doesn't believe it for a minute. She goes on, but if the guilt lies upon Creon, who judged me, then I pray may his punishment equal my own. That is a true, strong Greek sentiment. My last thought is he should get what's coming to him for treating me this way. In short, she is utterly strong, admirable, great, and womanly. Now, you might think that commentators would strive to outdo each other in singing her praises. Here is just a brief sample of standard interpretations taught regularly to college students from coast to coast. I wouldn't even dignify by telling you the name of the textbook from which I took these. Antigone represents the emotional resistance of the female to the ordered male reason of the state. See, Creon is law and order, rationality, and Antigone is female rebellion and unpredictability. Or another very common interpretation. After all, we all know that life requires compromise. And since she won't compromise, she's obviously a death worshiper. She has a martyr complex. She's a neurotic perfectionist. And of course, to these people, all perfection, and in fact, morality as such, is a neurosis. Now, of course, the Freudians make it very easy. She's in love with her dead brother sexually. And that's the whole motive of the thing, and she really wants to go back to his arms in the underworld, and that's it. The pragmatists today are the worst of all, I think. And their attitude is she's a senseless troublemaker. Why is she so polarizing and rigid? We know there are no absolutes, so what is all this, you know, causing a fuss for nothing? In other words, it may seem to you self-evident what the stature of Antigone is, but today you have to be an unusual person to respond to Antigone. And I'm very proud to say that I think she's fabulous, perfect, purely good, 100% right, and judged by objectivism, she is the top heroine possible. Now the question is, does Sophocles agree with me? Well, the answer, unfortunately, is yes and no. Obviously, he approves of her. He certainly comes down hard enough on Creon. He never says one negative thing about Antigone. But how does he interpret her? After all, it's his character. Well, you have to notice here that he makes her religious. She regularly invokes the gods as a source of morality. She states her motivation as respect for the divine injunctions. Now, of course, to the Greeks of this period, there was little knowledge of the idea that moral laws could be other than religious. The idea of a morality that was not based on religion did not exist. The dichotomy in the 5th century BC was between the sophists and the religionists. The sophists were the ones praising man, you know, man is the measure of all things. But they took that to mean relativism, skepticism, subjectivism, amoralism. Values are all arbitrary and might makes right. As against the religionists who were praising God, and that they thought was the basis of moral absolutes. Now, in that context, Sophocles was torn. He wanted a heroine, a strong-willed, self-assertive moralist. And yet this, to him, intellectually required a religious woman, a pious, observant believer. Now, the question is, would a pious woman act like Antigone? Or does Antigone have hubris? H-U-B-R-I-S. Now, that is a word often translated as pride, although the Greeks were in favor of something that we call pride. So to make a long story short, let us say that hubris means improper arrogance, a self-opinion that is unwarranted by facts, which the Greeks considered a major sin. So the question is, does Antigone have hubris? If so, then you can understand her comeuppance. Well, on the face of it, it doesn't look like she has. She says she's just doing her religious duty. She's upholding the laws of the gods. She's being the obedient servant of Zeus. But on the other hand, she is like no servant ever. The Greeks and Sophocles too expected the servant of God to be a servant of a higher power. So all recognized servants of God at this time, and even more so since, are supposed to be modest. You know, they have a little element of, I'm just the messenger, who am I to? No, you know, I just take orders. They're moderate. They don't go to extremes because they know they have these frailties, so they're willing to listen to advice. They're prepared to correct their ways when friends intervene. They know, in effect, well, I'm only human, and they watch their step in the scheme of things. Now, certainly Antigone is the opposite of all this. She is arrogant. She knows what's right, and to hell with everybody else, whether it's Creon or her sister, couldn't matter less to her. She's ruthless about her beliefs in a way that a modest, moderate, self-doubting religionist would never dream of being. So what does Sophocles make of her? He created her. Obviously, he loves her. And I think the final answer has to be that it's unclear from the play whether or not she does or doesn't have the sin of hubris. At least we're going to have to wait a little bit to find out. Now, of course, as an objectivist, I can say she is pure, to hell with the gods. She is proud, and good for her. But what Sophocles' exact opinion is, you see, there's some grounds to doubt here. We'll have to get a little bit more evidence. Now, notice that Antigone is widely disliked by commentators on the ground that she is, and I quote, a cold egotist, which she certainly is. And here, Christian commentators in particular like to point out Antigone's harsh rejection of her sister's belated support. You know, the sister comes and says, okay, I'm going to die with you too. And Antigone just brushes her aside. And it's obvious that she feels that Ismene does not understand her battle, does not hold values on the level that she does, and she doesn't want a useless sacrifice of her sister. So she just brushes her aside. But of course, to the Christians, what a monstrous and unfeeling thing to do, rather than to nourish your sister and say, okay, you can die with me, etc. So you see, your philosophy is essential in interpreting, in evaluating these characters. One commentator utters a truly wonderful sentence defining the character of Antigone. It's maybe the best sentence I ever found. I studied maybe 8 to 10 volumes for each of these plays of commentary, analysis, and this is about the best sentence I ever found for capturing a character briefly. And he says, quote, she is in love with the impossible and has a fury in her heart. And if by the impossible you mean justice, morality, it is a wonderful characterization of Antigone, and I have to add of Ayn Rand as well, because that sentence exactly captures her. And this is the closest character in all world literature to Ayn Rand as she actually was in person. And I'm prepared to testify to that on the basis of 30 years of knowing her. She was in love with the impossible, or what she would call, you know, justice, and she certainly had a fury in her heart about it. So I love Antigone and Sophocles for the genius of being able to imagine and bring alive so fantastically unique a character an entire century before Aristotle. For this alone, he goes in the pantheon. All right, now more briefly, a word about the other main character, Antigone's uncle, Creon. Now, he is a statist and, in fact, a totalitarian. And in several places, it reads as though Sophocles' Red Atlas shrugged and took Creon out of it. He makes these really extreme collectivist statements that are just too purposeful, too stylized to be accidental. For instance, he rejects private friendship in favor of the purely communal life. He denounces money as corrupting. He demands blind obedience to his decrees, quote, whether they're just or unjust, unquote. So he's the classic collectivist dictator, authoritarian, tyrannical, opposed to egoism, and actually highly conventional for the period. He spouts all the platitudes of the unthinking people in the 5th century BC. Military virtue is the supreme virtue. Women are inferiors. Sons must unquestioningly obey their fathers, etc. He's just a walking vessel of platitudes. So he's not strong like Antigone, but he is stubborn, bullheaded. He just digs his heels in and refuses to listen to reason. And this is most clearly dramatized in his intellectual helplessness before his son's display of rational arguments. He has no answers to Hymen, just bromides. And you can see his self-doubt and insecurity coming out in remarks like, I'm not going to be beaten by a woman. So, in a word, he is weak. And as someone put it, if Antigone is more than a woman, Creon is less than a man. But he is not depicted as purely evil. He has an element of stature, of dignity. He is articulate. We should only be able to speak like Creon. He's poised. And above all, of course, the main event that does something for his character is he atones, he changes, and he suffers when he finally realizes the error of his ways too late. Now, I question, does he atone out of some better element of his nature which asserts itself? Some recognition of morality which finally gets through to him? Or does he atone simply out of fear of divine retribution? Now, I don't think the play is entirely clear, but the evidence to me leads toward he atones out of fear more than anything else, because his atonement is very rapid. He doesn't go through any process of reintegrating or analysis. He's blundering along. He says, oh, the gods don't like it? Okay. So it's a little fast. To make us think that there is some profoundly better quality that's emerging here. Nevertheless, it's obvious that Sophocles expects us to sympathize with Creon at the end, to feel moved by his fate, as against feeling great, another rat bites the dust. His fate is moving. It's a lesson to mankind, not just a slap down of wickedness for its own sake. All right, and that brings us to number 5, the theme. Now, we haven't said anything yet about what this play means. Of course, we've implied a lot, but we haven't said it. A theme is the abstract meaning or message of a play's events. Now, abstract does not necessarily mean philosophical. There are non-philosophical themes abundant in detective stories, for instance, and on up. But all of our plays are highly philosophical, so all of the themes in this course will be too. Now, by the theme, we do not mean the same thing as the philosophy, the total philosophy of the work. Usually the theme is a single principle within a philosophy, the one issue dramatized by the play. Now, of course, the theme rests in the author's mind on an overall philosophy, implicit or explicit. And in great playwrights like ours, you can find this philosophy in the play also, but only at the end of your analysis. First, you find the theme, that's number 5. And then you try to identify the broader philosophy, which is the context that makes this theme possible. So first, we're going on a rising level of abstraction from the events and the characters on to what does that mean, on to the overall synoptic vision of the whole universe implied. Now, a typical theme is very easy to state because plays are a clash, a conflict between A and B. And one wins and one loses, or one is of the author's sympathy and the other the author hates. So generally, the typical theme will be something like the superiority of A's values over B's, or the primacy of A over B. Now, that little formula applies, of course, to Antigone, and there are 3 common ways, this is not always true of themes, but in this play, 3 common ways, all variants to Sophocles of the same idea, in which you can express the theme of the play. And we should be able to read these 3 off easily now, given our knowledge of the plot and the character. And here they are in no particular order. A, the primacy of morality over politics. In other words, of morality over political conformity. Or put this same point another way, moral principles are absolutes and come above any government decree. So therefore, if there's ever a clash between them, do what's right, not what the government or society expects. Let's say we condense that just into the primacy of morality over politics or over society. Now, a second formulation, the same idea to Sophocles, because remember, for him, moral law is divine law. So you could put it this way. The theme is the primacy of religious law over political law. Or, as this theme is also expressed, of God's law over man's law. Now, you hear this formulation to this very day from conservatives attacking the government. That we have to follow God's law, not man's. And that is obviously one of the themes of the Antigones. Now, this formulation is obviously dangerously close to the idea of the power of God's will over man's. In other words, the relative helplessness of man. And you can see that if you push this formulation, you're going to end up in a much more religious play than this is. But nevertheless, this theme is there in the play, and we have to acknowledge it. Now, the third, which is just another variant way of putting it, and they all tantamount to the same thing in the context. The primacy of the individual over the state. This is one of the earliest credos ever of individualism. It has something to do with why I picked it to start the course. Now notice, is Sophocles here championing the rights of the individual? No, there's no idea of individual rights yet. We're way too early for that. What he's championing is the individual's independent judgment as against obedience. He's saying, in effect, you, the individual, must follow your own conclusions no matter what the authorities tell you. So it's a moral issue, not a political issue. Now, I think you can see that these are remarkable messages for the 5th century BC, before we have such a thing as a secular code of ethics. Most men today, I venture to say, have not grasped these messages 1/100th as thoroughly as Sophocles did in the 5th century BC prior to the discovery of secular morality or logic or science. So I hope you're impressed that you can have such themes at such a time. I'm saving this for a spontaneous question. And instead of that, I am going to go on from these themes directly to number 6. This is just in case somebody asks a certain question about the theme. I happen to have a feeling someone will. All right, now I want to move in conclusion this morning, number 6, to the deeper philosophy of Sophocles. Now, I'm not going to get through it all today, but I want to set it up and then steal a few minutes from Shakespeare tomorrow and probably keep doing that all the way so that having got all this, you will have a question in mind to be answered in the first 5 or 10 minutes the next time. What is the deepest, widest meaning of all of it? What is he telling us in this play, beyond the obvious theme? But the first question we have to ask is, how are we going to find out what this broader philosophy is? And there's only two ways. From the events, including the characters and their fate, who wins, who loses, why, and from explicit philosophical statements, if there are any. Assuming that those statements are endorsed by the author and integrated to the rest of the play. If they're just thrown in, then you can ignore them. Now, the overall philosophy of a play is its final explanation, but you can reach it only at the end of your study. And until you know it, you do not fully understand the play, if it's a philosophical play. Now, for example, I'd like a show of hands here. A truthful answer, and I won't ask you to elaborate. I just want a yes or no. How many understand why Antigone dies in this play and has to die? Raise your hand if you understand. And now raise your hand if you don't understand. Well, that's great. That's terrific. The great majority of you do not understand why she has to die. And that's what you have to, grasping the philosophy will finally make every event in the play transparent. And at the same time, the event will integrate to the philosophy and finally make the philosophy crystal clear by concretization. And until you know this, this is the question about Antigone. You haven't really penetrated to its total meaning. Well, let's do some preliminary work of refining these the issue of the philosophy, and we'll leave the the summation for tomorrow. Now, that's the question I want you to come up with for homework. Why does Antigone have to die in this play? Well, let's get rid of, because she dies. Let's get rid of some wrong answers. It's sheer chance. No, that only happens on Broadway. This is much too purposeful a play. Everything in it is deliberate, stylized, selected. An event of that kind happening by women would be simply unheard of in Greece. At least it certainly wouldn't get on the stage and survive for thousands of years. Well, is it a political statement? After all, Kira dies at the end of We the Living. And the message there is the necessity of a society that respects the individual and the inability of the unusual individual to survive in a dictatorship. So if that were the theme of the Antigone, then we could understand her death on the model of Kira's death. But that is obviously not the answer. I put the vehemence in it because I had a 35-minute fight with one of the students in the preliminary seminar who insisted that this was We the Living, this play. It is not a political play. It makes no reference to what a proper society would be like. It makes no suggestion of a different kind of government. They have no idea of individual rights yet. And in fact, if you know Sophocles, he wouldn't believe an ideal society would be possible to man anyway, even if we could figure out what it was. We'll see why soon. So this play has nothing to do with Creon's evil in not recognizing rights. Sophocles didn't recognize rights yet either, so that's not the issue. So why does Antigone, with morality on her side, suffer and die? Why isn't she triumphant? Why doesn't it end with a note of ecstasy that she asserted herself and she upheld the right? Well, you have to remember that art is metaphysical, and so is this play. It expresses a vision of man, of life, of the universe. That's what Ayn Rand called metaphysical value judgments. Now, what are Sophocles' metaphysical value judgments as expressed in this play? Now, as a clue, not yet the answer, but as a clue, I'm going to refer to the four great odes in the play, conveniently called Ode 1, 2, 3, and 4. Each is a short speech, actually a song, integrated to the action. It's like four mini Rourke speeches, summarizing the meaning of what we have seen. And then we have to decide, what do they all add up to? How, in conjunction with the events, do they explain the play? Now, these odes, these four odes, have a definite logical structure. They're arranged in a definite order based on specific events that had to occur in a certain order. And each one of these odes tops or modifies the previous. Together, they give you the overall philosophy. And I want to stress that these odes are not merely appended to the action. It's not as though somebody said to Sophocles, give it a little depth here and throw in a song. They are integrated and they flow out of it, and they comment directly on what we have seen. And what we have seen itself is a logical progression, you know, from beginning, middle, and end. So these odes are an integral part of the play. And you should have no trouble with reading them except the fact that it's a chorus instead of a person. And you should be able to abstract from that. Ode 1 is the most famous. The ode to man, to the power of man. Where does it come? Well, I think the best way to answer that question, it comes right after we have seen a man. In other words, Antigone. We are now ready to appreciate her. Creon has just decreed her death. The messenger is sent to find the offender. And that is a time to think, what kind of a power is this being that he is going to sentence? Now, I have no words to tell you the eloquence of this ode. The concretization of man's power over nature. The brilliant metaphors, for instance, the birds and the fish tamed in the net of man's mind. The wonderful opening line, numberless are the world's wonders, but none more wonderful than man. And the word wonderful is like awesome, almost terrible in the sense of strikes fear in us to think of a being of this stature. This is one of the earliest pro-man statements in Western civilization. And that's not a surprise, therefore, that it comes in one of the most individualistic plays ever written. What is amazing philosophically is that it precedes both Plato and Aristotle. So it gives you an example of how virtuous the pagan Greeks were, no matter how religious they became. Their religiosity was picked up by the Christians and run into the ground or run into heaven. But the content of this ode is the distinctively Greek, and that's what you never find again after the triumph of Christianity. You just don't find it. So treasure it while you have it. Now, where this ode is going to lead, you can observe its ending. All these lines to how great man is, but what's the problem? In effect, death and taxes. He can't withstand death. He's mortal, and he's capable of being both good and evil, and that means of breaking the law. I took taxes as just an example of an odious law. And when he breaks the law, he suffers accordingly. Now, a big question. Who is being talked about at this point? Antigone is going to break Creon's law, but Creon is going to break God's law. So are we talking about both of them here? When we talk about the danger of breaking the law? Well, that's what you call a hook. It's a question that's thrown out. It's suggested by the action. And we'll have to consider it as the play continues. Now, if he had a little treatise here and said, no, I don't mean Antigone, he'd kill the suspense. We still are trying to find out, is Antigone right or is she wrong? So all he's telling us is here is man is great, but he must obey the law. Now, you can't quiz them and say, which law did you have in mind? Just wait and see. Now we skip to Ode 2, which occurs immediately after Creon has decided to take vengeance on Antigone. Now, the theme of this ode is not the power of man, but the power of God over man. Creon has captured Antigone, and here now we talk about the power of God's vengeance. Now, there's a reference here to the curse on her father, Oedipus, and the implication that she's still suffering for the curse on her family. If we follow that line, we render the play nonsense because we make the whole thing devoid of free will. So I just ignore that. Although that remnant is there. But notice that even if we put that aside, all of the formulations that are tremendously anti-man in this ode, anti-man and pro-God, such as, the dreams of men bring them ghosts of joy. Or man's little pleasure is the spring of sorrow. You know, pride goeth before a fall. Or no great things come to mortals without a curse. So it's the idea of the illusory nature of human achievement, the sin of hubris. Man has nothing in relation to God. Well, we have a lot of questions. Now, what does this do to Ode 1? What does it do to our interpretation of Antigone? Is she suffering the sin of hubris? Or is Creon? Well, he obviously is. But is she being cursed by the gods for being too great? Too assertive? Is she suffering sorrow because she asserted her own pleasures and her own judgment? On to Ode 3. Now, Ode 3 is devoted, notice, not to man or to God, but to something which we're told is higher than either. And that is going to give us a real clue. Well, it's right after Hymen breaks with Creon. Now, what did he break with him over? Hymen's is in love with Antigone. And, of course, Antigone is in the situation that she's in because she loves Polynices. And, of course, Antigone loves Hymen, and Hymen loves her. And Hymen also loves his father. So if we probe down to the bottom of these characters, in one form or another, what is it that motivates them? Love. So it's certainly appropriate at this point to have an ode to the power of love. Now, you see, you've got to read these things as growing out of the play. Not as... this is not Thomas Mann we're talking about, God forbid. You know, it's not as though he wrote some junk and then he felt the need for a speech to give it meaning. This has to come out of and be directly integrated with what we've seen. And observe the line that love is the most unconquerable power of all. Even the pure immortals, the gods, can't escape love. Even the most just of men will be brought to ruin by love. Love can turn the just man off his natural course and make him unjust and leave him ruined. So in a sense, even though love is a goddess Aphrodite, it's also conceived here as a passion even higher than the gods, a kind of unconquerable passion that plays havoc with the lives of men and gods alike. Now, you remember, of course, that the Greek gods were not all powerful. They play tricks, they get jealous, they engage in childish vengeance, they do all kinds of mischievous things. It seems in this ode that Socrates is saying that there seems to be no moral order in the universe. I say it seems to be that. Because above both man and gods comes this inexplicable passion which seems to move them both. Well, I would suggest that life is essentially unpredictable, that virtue is not necessarily rewarded, because the universe has a certain caprice at its heart. And in this connection, observe the messenger's speech about the whims of fate, including the line, quote, fate cast down the happy and the unhappy alike, as though it just doesn't care whether you're good or bad. If your number's up, that's it. So it's starting to look different from what it did in Ode 1. Now we get to Ode 4, the last one. This takes place immediately after Antigone is sentenced and leaves the stage to suffer forever. This final ode tells us just what we would expect given the first three. It reminds us of the great mythological victims of the past. You know, to the Greeks, myths were like an extended family. They knew them all. And you don't have to bother looking them up. Just take it for granted that these are people you've lived with all your life and you know them all thoroughly. And they're simply reminding you that the gods or passion or fate or whatever you want to call it have a history of visiting suffering, sometimes deserved but sometimes undeserved, suffering upon the beautiful and the good. So we have here an ode for a kind of review of the, well, I'll call it the malevolence or the inexplicability of life. So in essence, the logical structure of the four put together is like this. Man is great, but God is so great as to reduce man to nothing. And passion is above even God. So fate is unpredictable and tragedy is to be expected. And now we've got to think, why did Antigone have to die in this story? Well, Creon's fate is simple enough. He's brutally punished because he defied God's law. That's definitely hubris. That's inherent in the theme. He represents the bad guy in the theme and in the action, so he comes to death. There's no mystery. But why doesn't Antigone, wholly virtuous, emerge triumphant? What is the key to Sophocles' universe that ultimately explains this play? Now I'm going to steal a few minutes from Shakespeare next time to give you the answers. And we'll draw a line and have some questions now on Antigone up to this point. Thank you. No, I'm very happy that we got some questions in because I had promised questions and my desperate expedient is to cancel question periods. But it worked out just well. So let's take questions. Yes. Now, apparently if you speak, I don't have to repeat, so you tell me if you can all hear this.
Okay. I noticed that your statement of the plot theme of Antigone consists of three key elements. One, the protagonist. Two, the central value the protagonist is pursuing. And three, the central conflict that she runs into. Does every plot theme have these three essential elements? And did you deliberately choose the order in which these three elements appear in your statement of Antigone's plot theme?
Okay, that's a good question. Every plot theme has to make reference to the protagonist because it's telling you about some person in conflict with somebody else. And if you don't get the person in the plot theme, there's no story. It does have to imply the central conflict, if not state it. That's why the first thing you read out, she defies him. He becomes jealous, you know, whatever it happens to be, he has to kill so-and-so. So the central conflict has to be there. You are wrong in saying the central value. I did not state the central value in the plot theme, except in the broadest generality. I said she defies him over a moral issue. But now what the issue was, that she loved her brother, that she wanted him to be buried, even that she was a moral idealist, I didn't say. So that's already a little too specific. In some plot themes, you can't get the situation unless you know specifically what they're after. In another, as long as you know there's a clash, you can leave it to the development of the plot. In terms of order, you have to have entity before action. So you have to have a character before it can do something. So the typical plot theme is A does B to C, or A and C clash over B. Steve.
You say that Sophocles believes that morality is divine, but this certainly could have been a more religious play. And you say that the main conflict over morality in this days was between the sophists and God.
Yes.
Well, what was Sophocles' attitude toward the sophists and a more secular morality?
Terrific question. I just happen to have some material here. Sophocles liked the sophists who were, remember, the champions of man and of this world. All of philosophy has been a false alternative with rare exceptions. The otherworldly religious types who were for moral absolutes and God thought man was low and life was worthless. And the worldly types who said we have to judge by human standards, God is a myth or unknowable. And then they could never find any standards, so they were skeptics or subjectivists or brutes. Now, Sophocles was torn here. I think that he would have really gone for the idea of an objective, absolute moral code that was based on reason in this life, but he didn't have it and he didn't invent it. So we know this much. He was much less religious than his predecessor, Aeschylus. He was worldly. He admired strength here on earth. He agreed with the sophists and admired them for stressing man and turning the focus away from the other world to this one. But he couldn't tolerate the idea of subjectivism, might makes right, there is no morality. And therefore he felt, somehow I have to put religion into the mix. And of course what he's groping for, I think, is an objective approach to morality, and he had no idea how, if you drop God, you could get that. Now, the best way to put this to you in the way it actually stood for the Greeks of that period is to tell you that in the 5th century BC, the Greeks were wrestling with the distinction between two crucial concepts. Physis, phusis, which means roughly nature or reality. It's where we get the word physics from. And nomos, N-O-M-O-S, which means law, nomothetic, etc. So phusis is essentially nature, what's given us by reality. Nomos is law, something which is stated by man or decreed by man. Now, there was a lot of confusion, and people used them all in different terms and so on, but what it comes down to is what Ayn Rand called the metaphysical versus the man-made. This was the first groping attempt to make that distinction. Now, the sophists at the time were the champions of which one? Which one? Nomos. Right. Because to them, phusis, reality, nature, was unknowable, subjective. The senses didn't bring you in contact. Each man must put in his own subjective world and so on. And therefore, their attitude was, there's no objective ethics either. It's a matter of what each of us feels, whatever the state decrees. Therefore, if the state is strong enough to impose its will, you have to obey. Remember, Thrasymachus, justice is the interest of the stronger. Now, Sophocles comes in as a defender of reality of phusis. He says, oh, you should obey the law. You should do your duty as a citizen, to borrow from the later Bible anachronistically. You render unto nomos what is nomos. But you owe your primary allegiance to phusis, to nature. If men's edicts conflict with nature or reality, then you have to assert yourself and recognize reality and follow reality, even if it means condemnation by mankind. Now, you see, he couldn't be consistent with that. It's too early philosophically. But by implication, it would imply that a real morality is based on phusis, on nature, on reality, and not on